You're tuned in to The Sharon Now with me, Sharon James, just starting on Laguna's KX93.5. And my show tonight is about some of the dangers related to this relatively new internet culture. And tonight I'm going to bring you a handful of people, most of whom were WizKids involved in its inception. And they all seem to be as scared about the direction in which it's headed as us old farts, who are a little leerier of it and its claims to be nothing but an instrument of progress for the human race. It certainly has some immense advantages, but it's also accumulated some serious drawbacks over the years that are maybe just beginning to emerge and create a conversation. One that notably spurred Chris Hughes, Mark Zuckerberg's former roommate and original partner in Facebook, to write a rather crushing editorial about Facebook in last weekend's New York Times. And we're going to hear the crux of that opinion piece from Chris Hughes himself later in this sharing hour. But I'm going to start with Tristan Harris and let him introduce himself through his TED Talk.
I was a design ethicist at Google, where I studied how do you ethically steer people's thoughts. When we talk about technology, we tend to talk about it as this blue sky opportunity. It could go any direction, but it's going in a very specific direction. There's a hidden goal driving the direction of all of the technology we make. And that goal is the race for our attention. Because every news site, elections, politicians, games, even meditation apps, have to compete for one thing, which is our attention. And there's only so much of it. And what we don't talk about is a handful of people working at a handful of technology companies, hunched over at desks with little dials, through their choices will shape the thoughts and feelings of a billion people. When you pull out your phone and they design how this works or what's on the feed, it's scheduling little blocks of time in our minds. If you see a notification, it schedules you to have thoughts that maybe you didn't intend to have. If you swipe over that notification, it schedules you into spending a little bit of time getting sucked into something that maybe you didn't intend to get sucked into. And the best way to get people's attention is to know how someone's mind works. And there's a whole bunch of persuasive techniques that I learned in college at a lab called the Persuasive Technology Lab to get people's attention. A simple example is YouTube. YouTube wants to maximize how much time you spend. And so what do? They autoplay the next video. And let's say that works really well. They're getting a little bit more of people's time. Well, if you're Netflix, you look at that and say, well, that's shrinking my market share, so I'm going to autoplay the next episode. But then if you're Facebook, you say, well, no, that's shrinking all of my market share, so now I have to autoplay all the videos in the newsfeed before waiting for you to click play. So the internet is not evolving at random. The reason it feels like it's sucking us in the way it is because of this race for attention. We know where this is going. Technology is not neutral. And it becomes this race to the bottom of the brainstem of who can go lower to get it. Let me give you an example of Snapchat. If you didn't know, Snapchat is the number one way that teenagers in the United States communicate. So if you're like me and you use text messages to communicate, Snapchat is that for teenagers. And there's like 100 million of them that use it. And they invented a feature called Snapstreaks, which shows the number of days in a row that two people have communicated with each other. In other words, what they just did is they gave two people something they don't want to lose. Because if you're a teenager and you have 150 days in a row, you don't want that to go away. And so think of the little blocks of time that that schedules in kids' minds. This isn't theoretical. When kids go on vacation, it's been shown they give their passwords to up to five other friends to keep their snap streaks going, even when they can't do it. And they have like 30 of these things, and so they have to get through taking photos of just pictures or walls or ceilings just to get through their day. So it's not even like they're having real conversations. We have a temptation to think about this as, oh, they're just using Snapchat the way we used to gossip on the telephone. It's probably okay. Well, what this misses is that in the 1970s, when you were just gossiping on the telephone, there wasn't 100 engineers on the other side of the screen who knew exactly how your psychology worked and orchestrated you into a double bind with each other. Now, if this is making you feel a little bit of outrage, notice that that thought just comes over you. Outrage is a really good way also of getting your attention. Because we don't choose outrage, it happens to us. And if you're the Facebook newsfeed, whether you'd want to or not, you actually benefit when there's outrage. Because outrage doesn't just schedule a reaction in emotional time space for you. We want to share that outrage with other people. So we want to hit share and say, can you believe the thing that they said? And so outrage works really well at getting attention, such that if Facebook had a choice between showing you the outrage feed and a calm news feed, they would want to show you the outrage feed, not because someone consciously chose that, but because that worked better at getting your attention. And the news feed control room is not accountable to us. It's only accountable to maximizing attention. It's also accountable because of the business model of advertising. For anybody who can pay the most to actually walk into the control room and say, that group over there, I want to schedule these thoughts into their minds. So you can precisely target a lie directly to the people who are most susceptible. And because this is profitable, it's only going to get worse. I don't know a more urgent problem than this, because the costs are so obvious. This problem is underneath all other problems. It's not just taking away our agency to spend our attention and live the lives that we want. It's changing the way we have our conversations, it's changing our democracy, and it's changing our ability to have the conversations and relationships we want with each other. And it affects everyone, because 1 billion people have one of these in their pocket.
One of these, of course, being a smartphone. Does what he's saying scare you, listener? Because it does me. I'm Sharon James, and this is the Sharon Hour on Laguna's KX935, with the only somewhat ironic title tonight, Tectonic Disturbances. We're currently listening to former Google designer Tristan Harris outline what he sees as the existing inherent problems with the business model for the internet. But he has some thoughts on how to fix them.
We need to make 3 radical changes to technology and to our society. The first is we need to acknowledge that we are persuadable. Once you start understanding that your mind can be scheduled into having little thoughts or little blocks of time that you didn't choose, wouldn't we want to use that understanding and protect against the way that that happens? I think we need to see ourselves fundamentally in a new way. It's almost like a new period of human history, like the Enlightenment, but a kind of self-aware enlightenment, that we can be persuaded. The second is we need new models and accountability systems. So that as the world gets better and more persuasive over time, because it's only going to get more persuasive, the people in those control rooms are accountable and transparent to what we want. The only form of ethical persuasion that exists is when the goals of the persuader are aligned with the goals of the persuadee. And that involves questioning big things like the business model of advertising. Lastly, we need a design renaissance. Because once you have this view of human nature, that you can steer the timelines of 1 billion people. Just imagine there's people who have some desire about what they want to do and what they want to be thinking and what they want to be feeling and how they want to be informed. And we're all just tugged into these other directions, and you have 1 billion people just tugged into all these different directions. Well, imagine an entire design renaissance that tried to orchestrate the exact and most empowering time well spent way for those timelines to happen. And that would involve 2 things. One would be protecting against the timelines that we don't want to be experiencing, the thoughts that we wouldn't want to be happening, so when that ding happens, not having the ding that sends us away. And the second would be empowering us to live out the timeline that we want. So let me give you a concrete example. Let's say your friend cancels dinner on you, and you are feeling a little bit lonely, and so what do you do in that moment? You open up Facebook. In that moment, the designers in the control room want to schedule exactly one thing, which is to maximize how much time you spend on the screen. Now instead, imagine if those designers created a different timeline that was the easiest way in using all of their data to actually help you get out with the people that you care about, if that was the timeline that Facebook wanted to make possible for people. Or imagine a different conversation where, let's say you wanted to post something super controversial on Facebook, which is a really important thing to be able to do, to talk about controversial topics. And imagine there was a button there saying, well, what would be most time well spent for you? And you clicked host a dinner. And right there underneath the item, it said, who wants to RSVP for the dinner? And so you'd still have a conversation about something controversial, but you'd be having it in the most empowering place on your timeline, which would be at home that night with a bunch of friends over to talk about it. So imagine we're running like a find and replace on all of the timelines that are currently steering us towards more and more screen time persuasively, and replacing all of those timelines with what do we want in our lives? Instead of handicapping our attention, imagine if we used all of this data and all of this power and this new view of human nature to give us a superhuman ability to focus. and a superhuman ability to put our attention on what we cared about, and a superhuman ability to have the conversations that we need to have for democracy. The most complex challenges in the world require us not just to use our attention individually, they require us to use our attention and coordinate it together. Climate change is going to require that a lot of people are being able to coordinate their attention in the most empowering way together. And imagine creating a superhuman ability to do that. Sometimes the world's most pressing and important problems are not these hypothetical future things that we could create. Sometimes the most pressing problems are the ones that are right underneath our noses, the things that are already directing a billion people's thoughts. And maybe instead of getting excited about the new augmented reality and virtual reality and these cool things that could happen, which are going to be susceptible to the same race for attention, we could fix the race for attention on the thing that's already in a billion people's pockets. Maybe instead of getting excited about the most exciting, new, cool, fancy education apps, we could fix the way kids' minds are getting manipulated into sending empty messages back and forth. Maybe instead of worrying about hypothetical future runaway artificial intelligences that are maximizing for one goal, we could solve the runaway artificial intelligence that already exists right now, which are these news feeds maximizing for one thing. It's almost like instead of running away to colonize new planets, we could fix the one that we're already on. Solving this problem is critical infrastructure for solving every other problem. There's nothing in your life or in our collective problems that does not require our ability to put our attention where we care about. At the end of our lives, all we have is our attention and our time.
It's true. That was Tristan Harris at his TED Talk, brought to you here tonight on this The Sharon Hour, me, Sharon James, on Laguna's KX935, talking tonight about the direction technology is dragging us, as it were. After this TED Talk, Chris Anderson, who runs this incredibly high-powered conference, came up for a Q&A with Tristan Harris, former internet designer for Google, now concerned citizen about the dangers of how the internet is currently being designed. It should be acknowledged here that TED is largely a convention for tech people, so is very involved with technological innovations, especially in creative areas like design. That's what TED stands for: technology, entertainment, design.
Some people listening might say, well, look, what you complain about is addiction and all these people doing this stuff. For them, it's actually interesting. All these design decisions have built user content. This is fantastically interesting. The world's more interesting than it ever has been. Right. What's possibly wrong with that?
Well, one way to see this is YouTube, for example. You want to always show the more interesting next video. You want to be better and better at suggesting that next video. But even if you could propose the perfect next video that everyone would want to watch, it would just be better and better at keeping you hooked on the screen. So what's missing in that equation is figuring out what our boundaries would be, right? You would want YouTube to know something about, say, falling asleep. The CEO of Netflix recently said that our biggest competitors are Facebook, YouTube, and sleep, right? And so what we need to recognize is that the human architecture is limited and that we have certain boundaries or dimensions of our lives that we want to be honored and respected. And technology could help do that.
I mean, could you make the case that part of the problem here is that we've got a naive model of human nature? So much of this is justified in terms of human preference. We've got these algorithms that do an amazing job of optimizing for human preference. But which preference? There's the preferences of things that we really care about when we think about them versus the preferences of what we just instinctively click on. If you could implant that more nuanced view of human nature in every designer, would that be a step forward?
Absolutely. I mean, I think right now it's as if all of our technology is basically only asking our lizard brain, what's the best way to just impulsively get you to do the next tiniest thing with your time? Instead of asking you in your life, what would be most time well spent for you? What would be the perfect timeline that might include something later?
So if Facebook and Google and everyone said to us first up, hey, would you like us to optimize for your reflective brain or your lizard brain? You choose.
Right. That would be one way. Yes.
And when you said persuadability, that's an interesting word to me, because to me there's two different types of persuadability. There's the persuadability that we're trying right now of reason and thinking and making an argument. But I think you're almost talking about a different kind of more visceral type of persuadability, yeah, of being persuaded without even knowing that you're thinking.
Exactly, yeah. The reason I care about this problem so much is I studied at a lab called the Persuasive Technology Lab at Stanford that taught people exactly these techniques. There's conferences and workshops that teach people all these covert ways of getting people's attention and orchestrating people's lives. And it's because most people don't know that that exists that this conversation is so important.
You and I, you know, we both know so many people from all these companies, and I don't know about you, but my experience of them is that there is no shortage of good intent. People want a better world. They really want it. And I don't think anything you're saying is evil people. It's that there's these unintended consequences that have really got out of control.
Of this race for attention, yeah. It's the classic race to the bottom, that when you have to get attention and it's so tense, the only way to get more is to go lower on the brainstem, you know, to go lower into outrage, to go lower into emotion, to go lower into the lizard brain.
Quick reminder that you're tuned to The Sharer Now, and me, Sharon James, on Laguna's KX935, talking about the dangers of the internet model at the moment. The addictive nature of the internet is turning us into lemmings, and it could lead us off a cliff. It is leading us off a cliff because it's stripping us of our individuality by trying to box us into pigeonholes. All these animal illusions, but there you go. That's the danger. We're being reduced to our lowest potential and not our highest. Just thinking freely, thinking out of the box, not being guided into one. And that's unfortunately what our search engines are doing right now. They're saying, we got your number, we got most of your information, your age and demographic and socioeconomic status and your shopping habits and your viewing habits. So you've got your number, you like that show, we think you'll like this show, you bought that, we think you'd like to buy this. And if we're too lazy to think for ourselves, it can be helpful, but it's also muting that part of ourselves that thinks for ourselves, creating a kind of generic personality for us all, where free thinking could lead us in different, more interesting, more humane directions, perhaps. Certainly more individualistic ones. So that there aren't a handful or less of organizations or even individuals steering our future and our potential. In case you don't know about the lizard brain is the amygdala, the original part of our brain, the seat of our fundamental needs to eat, sleep, fight, reproduce. It's our basic animal brain, if you will. Homo sapiens ultimately grew a larger cortex. Well, here from author Seth Godin, here's as good a description as any of the lizard brain.
The lizard brain is the brain that you see if you look at a sonogram of a fetus. A little early fetus has a tail and has a little tiny thing on the top of its brain stem. And it turns out that all lizards have is a lizard brain, amygdala. And the idea of the lizard brain is this: it is hungry, it is scared, it is selfish, and it is horny. That's its job. And that's all it does. The reason they call wild animals wild is because they have lizard brains. And all they care about in any given moment when you see a squirrel scampering across the street is, how am I going to survive? How am I going to have kids? Get me out of here. It turns out that we have one too. And that as evolution came along, that little one went there and then we grew this new one on top. The limbic system and the neocortex. That's what dogs had first and then apes and people like us. That part is all about, how do I share? How do I be loyal? How do I connect? And then the part on top of that is, how do I come up with a really cool way to do something? How do I break tradition? How do I challenge the status quo?
And when the status quo means we're being fed alternative interpretations as alternative facts, all the more reason for individuals, unbrainwashed individuals, to come forward and say, whoa, this is not a world I want for my children, where there is no distinguishing between fact and fiction, where we're being persuaded that lies are the truth and truth are lies, or we're being railroaded into a certain direction that we don't necessarily endorse or believe in. And that's assuming we're consciously aware of what we're being fed. Because along with employing its subliminal tactics, what the internet has wrought is uncurated so-called truths and navigating our way through the morass of interpretations by not necessarily qualified people is incredibly difficult, especially for young people or people with little experience of the world and its history, or anyone who's insufficiently educated in scientific or even societal matters, which you could say of the majority of us. You're tuned to Laguna's KX935. This is The Sharer Hour. I'm Sharon James. And I'm broaching tonight the subject of the dangers of the internet and technology, the way it's going, the way it's being modeled for our future. And my perspective on this is that the time has come for us all to have our antennae up and to share our alternative interpretations as such, rather than presenting them as alternative facts. Finding the truth when we are being pushed into areas that people more powerful than us want to push us into is a dangerous place to be. And my next speaker, Jay Van Bevel, who teaches psychology and neuroscience at NYU, offers his perspective on just that.
If you're like me, the first thing you do in the morning is roll over, I turn on my phone, and I check my favorite news sites. And what I'm doing there is that I'm seeing different news, different facts are reaching my mind that are probably different than my neighbor because I select news sites that I enjoy. The other thing that happens is that I check my social media. And if you're not aware of this now, we are living in echo chambers. Our social media, because of our likes and dislikes, becomes a reflection of our own values. So you can go to the Wall Street Journal. They have this amazing website where you can select many, many political issues, like immigration. And you can see what a liberal and a conservative are seeing in their social media feeds at the exact same time, at that moment. And it is shocking how people are being fed different news sources. How are we going to agree if we're seeing radically different interpretations of reality? So that's already a massive problem. But the problem goes much deeper than that. Our brains are misinterpreting and processing information differently. And so we have these beautiful prefrontal cortices, and this is what differentiates us from every other primate on Earth. It's what allows us to build beautiful buildings, to organize events, to cooperate, to fly in airplanes. We have an enormous capacity that's given to us by our prefrontal cortices. But what they do when we're motivated is reason in ways that can be detrimental. So I'm sure all of you would agree that an educated citizenry is key to helping people see truth and learn how to distinguish fact from fiction, right? Well, that's wrong. There is a recent study that had people solve a math problem, and the solution either led to the conclusion that gun control was ineffective or that gun control is effective. And what happened was that liberals were able to solve the question pretty well, but only if it supported their belief system, only if it came to the conclusion that gun control was effective. When it wasn't effective, they failed badly. And this was true even of people who were very skilled at math. When conservatives did it, they found the exact opposite effect. And so what this study shows is that math skills and education and understanding might be thought to bring us closer together, but in fact, it can lead us further apart. When we're motivated, we reason in ways that support our initial belief systems. And this is one way that politics really does rot your brain. There's also good evidence that we remember things differently. So many people, millions of people, continue to believe that there were weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. This was considered the greatest intelligence failure in history. That led to a massive disaster, tens of thousands of people dying, hundreds of thousands of people being injured and displaced, hundreds of thousands of people with psychological trauma to this day that are being treated. But that's not just a conservative problem. There's a recent study by researchers who study how false memories get implanted in people's brains. And what they found is that conservatives are far more likely to remember false memories that were consistent with their beliefs. Conservatives were likely to remember that Barack Obama was meeting with the president of Iran, which didn't happen. They actually remembered it as being true. There is some evidence that our politics might even shape our interpretations of basic facts and reality. One of my favorite studies in this area presented people with a video of a protest and police were coming to arrest protesters. In this case, they either told participants that these were anti-abortion protesters or not. And what they found is that liberals thought that the protesters were much more violent when they were described as anti-abortion protesters, and conservatives thought they were peaceful. And so these people were seeing the exact same video to their retina, to their perceptual system, and drawing opposite conclusions about what had happened. And you can think of how this might impact how we all see the news. Even if we are reading the same news, watching the same channels, we're interpreting it through different lenses. Now, imagine that you could give people an antidote to help them see clearly, to open their eyes. What would you do? I'm going to give you three pieces of advice that might help. The first one is that you have to consider the possibility that you're wrong, that you're misperceiving reality. Everybody thinks they're seeing reality, even when they're not. This is known as naive realism. And so you first need to check your facts to ensure that you're correct and that you're not the one misperceiving things. The second thing is that fact checks do work, and people can reason effectively when they're presented with data. But it doesn't happen if they're presented with data from somebody they don't trust. And so the erosion of trust in the media is a huge problem because it means that people aren't going to accept the facts when they're presented to them from those sources. So you have to present it from a fact source that people actually trust. And third, you need to open people's minds. And what research suggests is one of the best ways to do that is to listen to somebody's perspective and affirm their common humanity. Listening helps you understand why they believe what they do and potentially find a ground for convincing them or correcting their misinterpretations, or maybe understanding that they have alternative insight that you don't have. And affirming them is key to making them less defensive, because if people are defensive about their beliefs, which we know they are, they can react. And some people have even called this the backfire effect, where you present people with vaccination facts about how it's effective. They sometimes can even double down and harden their original beliefs. So you have to be very careful in how you approach people when you try to convince them of some truth. Now, this is just a first step for opening a dialogue, trying to talk to people and trying to share a common sense of reality. But it's a critical first step, because if we're going to solve major issues and save our democracy, you need to start by having a common basis.
Not so surprising that liberals and conservatives think differently, but the fact that they calculate differently and maybe have inherent differences in their cognition, the way they come to conclusions, is interesting. And by the way, that was confirmed in a study in the Quarterly Journal of Experimental Psychology. But I'd also read an article in the Daily Beast about an experiment done at Northwestern University in Chicago, where students were given three different words and were asked to come up with another word, a different word, that could compound with each of those three words. For instance, if the given words were bath, ball, sun, the solution compound word would be room, because it would be bathroom, ballroom, sunroom. So the liberals and the conservatives came up with the same amount of solution words, but used different strategies. Conservatives apparently were more gradual and analytical, while liberals relied on aha moments, if you will, when they came up with their solutions. That sort of seems to be the reverse of what you'd expect, because conservatives are often considered the ones that rely on intuition and gut instincts, whereas liberals are known to be more logical and reasoned. But actually, it does make sense, because conservatives like to avoid risks and maybe play things safe, and their thinking is usually more methodical, approaching problems with a tried and true method. Whereas insight involves creative solutions and out-of-the-box thinking. It could help explain why liberals are more in favor of science and technology, which can offer more innovative and experimental solutions to problems. So it's not as if one way of problem solving is any smarter or better than the other, although it does indicate that liberals tend to be more flexible and tolerant of complexity and novelty, while conservatives are more rigid, resistant to change, and prefer clear-cut answers. But what's most interesting is that other research, not just limited to this particular experiment, has shown that different brain circuits are active during the different kinds of analytical problem solving. So in addition to their different approaches to policy, conservatives and liberals tend to have different brain structures, which would give credence to the fact that neural pathways are formed by consistent ways of thinking, something I talked about in last week's share now. A 2008 study of college kids found that conservatives owned more things that related to an orderly life, like cleaning supplies and calendars, whereas liberals had more travel-related items and books. Again, this suggests that conservatives have a more organized cognitive structure than liberals, whereas liberals seek out novelty. Another study published in the journal Behavioral and Brain Sciences found that conservatives have what psychologists call a negativity bias, whereas liberals have a more positive one. Liberals and conservatives were put in front of a computer screen and shown collages of both negative and positive images, and it became apparent that liberals spent more time inspecting the more positive objects, like a cute bunny rabbit or a cheerful child, whereas conservatives spent more of their time and attention on things like spiders or other threatening images, which would indicate that conservatives are inclined to dwell on threats and be more fearful of things liberals might dismiss as natural, and could help explain why conservatives are typically more fearful of people from different ethnic backgrounds, change, and expanding government. If we're to agree to the hopeful concept expressed by the last speaker, this doesn't mean that liberals and conservatives can't find common ground just because they approach and solve problems in different ways, but it probably helps to know that they have this difference in cognitive thinking. Certainly if we get into debates with each other, one would think that would be useful to know. You're tuned to The Sharer now with me, Sharon James, on Laguna's one and only KX93.5. And I'm mentioning all this because of the way we are shaped by the ideas and images we're fed. And a lot of those these days come from the internet. And even for the liberals who apparently tend to view images more positively, or at least focus on the more positive images, can't believe that's always true, but so research seems to have discovered, exposure to such things is worth considering for good and bad. The fact that we're being targeted as either conservatives or liberals with very specific ways of thinking by our search engines, aka Google, thereby narrowing our options for discovering the truth, is what is disturbing. You're tuned to The Sharer now with me, Sharon James, on Laguna's KX93.5, talking about what's going on in technology these days, and on my old soapbox about the fact that we are basically being run and manipulated now by three or four platforms: Google, Amazon, Facebook. We're basically at their mercy. They seem to be eliminating competition. It's very un-American. Who's stopping these monopolies? Where are the antitrust laws? And this has been worrying me for a long time, but all of a sudden it seems that even the initial promoters of these platforms, even the initiators in certain cases, are also getting worried by the power that they wield now that they've relinquished their places within that power structure. Big article in the New York Times by Mark Zuckerberg's partner in the formation of Facebook, Chris Hughes. He was his college roommate. Together they founded Facebook. And this weekend he wrote a 3-page opinion piece, front page of the New York Times Sunday Review, titled, "It's Time to Break Up Facebook." He says, quote, "The company I helped him build is a threat to our economy and democracy." He says Mark's personal reputation and Facebook's reputation have taken a nosedive. He cites sloppy privacy practices that drop tens of millions of users' data into a political consulting firm's lap, the slow response to Russian agents, to violent rhetoric, to fake news, the unbounded drive to capture ever more of our time and attention. These he sees as major mistakes on the part of this behemoth. And he says, even though it's been 15 years since he co-founded Facebook at Harvard and he hasn't worked there for over a decade, he feels angry and responsible for its current state of being. And even though he claims continuing love for Zuckerberg, he finds the power he wields problematic because his influence is so far beyond that of anyone else in the private sector or in government. He controls 3 core communication platforms: Facebook, Instagram, WhatsApp, used by billions of people every day. And he says Facebook's board works more like an advisory committee than an overseer because Mark controls around 60% of voting shares. It's Zuckerberg alone who can decide how to configure Facebook's algorithms to determine what people see in their news feeds, what privacy settings they can and can't use, and even which messages get delivered. In addition, when it comes to competition, he can shut down his competitors by acquiring, blocking, or copying them. He said he's disappointed in himself too, and the early Facebook team, that they didn't think ahead about how the newsfeed algorithm could change our entire culture, could influence elections, could empower nationalist leaders. And he's worried that with all his power, Mark Zuckerberg has surrounded himself with people that reinforce his beliefs instead of challenging them. And it means that it's the government's place to hold Mark accountable. For too long, they've overlooked their responsibility to ensure that the marketplace remains competitive. And even though the FTC is expected to impose a $5 billion fine on the company for their failure to protect our privacy, He says that's not enough, and nor is Facebook's offer to appoint some kind of privacy czar. He says after Mark's congressional testimony last year, there should have been calls for him to truly reckon with his mistakes. Instead, the legislators who questioned him were derided as too old and out of touch to understand how tech works. And that was the exact impression Mark wanted Americans to have, because it means he doesn't have to change anything. Okay, I'm going to pause here just to remind you that I'm reading an editorial by Chris Hughes, written in the New York Times. He was Mark Zuckerberg's former partner and co-creator of Facebook. I'm Sharon James, and you're listening to my show, The Sharon Hour, on Laguna's KX935. And I'm an older American, probably like those people questioning Zuckerberg, and I seem more concerned about the privacy factors that are a component of the more disturbing issues with the internet than my younger friends. But I do remember someone saying, okay, you're not concerned with privacy. How about you give me all your passwords right now? Or your bank account number? Or your mother's maiden name? Thing is, we do all have stuff to hide, even those of us who say we don't. There are things we want to keep private and things that we need to keep private for our own security. And all of those are at risk. So for those who say government intervention is worse, it's really not. Hughes says, we're a nation with a tradition of reigning in monopolies. No matter how well-intentioned the leaders of these companies may be, and Zuckerberg's power is un-American and unprecedented, and Facebook needs to be broken up. He points out that America was built on the idea that power should not be concentrated in any one person, because we're all fallible, and that's why the founders created a system of checks and balances. They foresaw the threat that gargantuan companies could pose to democracy. Jefferson, Madison, Adam Smith all believed that monopolies prevent the competition that spurs innovation and leads to economic growth. He quotes John Sherman, when the rise of the oil, railroad, and banking trusts of the Gilded Age presented that threat, as saying, if we will not endure a king as a political power, we should not endure a king over the production, transportation, and sale of any of the necessities of life. If we would not submit to an emperor, we should not submit to an autocrat of trade with power to prevent competition and to fix the price of any commodity. It was the Sherman Antitrust Act of 1890 that outlawed monopolies, and that was followed by even more legislation in the 20th century, creating structures to promote competition and hold the biggest companies accountable. It's why the Department of Justice broke up monopolies like Standard Oil and AT&T, and why he says the same needs to happen with Facebook. I mean, we have antitrust laws in place. They're just not being enforced. Here's Chris Hughes in his own words.
I haven't been at the company in over a decade, but I feel a sense of responsibility to account for the damage done. Every week brings new headlines about privacy violations, election interference, or mental health concerns. I think Facebook has grown too big and too powerful. Americans have the power to right the ship through government action. We need new regulations. It's time to break up Facebook. The early days of Facebook tell a classic American story of innovation and entrepreneurship. From our college dorm room, we started a little social network for our friends that exploded in popularity and connected the world. Mark's hustle in those early years made it possible for Facebook to dominate our rivals like Friendster, MySpace, Tumblr, and many others. These competitors made us better. This is how it's supposed to work in America. Hard work leads to economic success. You start a small business and compete on the merits to provide a better product. Today, nearly 3 billion people use Facebook, Instagram, and WhatsApp, and they're all owned and controlled by the same company. Of every dollar spent buying ads on social media, 84 cents goes to Facebook. It's now worth over $500 billion. That's roughly the size of the GDP of the bottom 65 countries in the world combined. It's not just that Facebook is a really big social network, it's everything. When a single company dominates any market, they become susceptible to abusing their power. There used to be plenty of healthy competition, but now many industries are controlled by just one or two companies. I often hear people say, I'm shutting down my Facebook account. Thank God for Instagram.
not realizing that Instagram is owned by Facebook. People are powerless in this situation because there's nowhere else to go. Facebook snatches up competitors by buying them before they get too big, or by copying their innovations. Monopolies stifle innovation. Despite all the money and hype being poured into new startups, there hasn't been a single major social media platform launched since 2011. The harm goes beyond the economy. It goes to democracy itself. When companies become empires, people are stripped of power. Facebook's employees write complex rules called algorithms that decide what you see in your newsfeed. Facebook can decide what messages get delivered and which don't, and what exactly makes for violent or inappropriate content. Even Mark himself has said that he and the Facebook team have too much power over speech. Facebook does have a board of directors, but Mark owns the majority of the shares. Unlike the leader of a democracy, there are no checks and balances on Facebook. Mark has no boss, and he cannot be fired. Listen, it'd be great if Mark could fix this himself, but this, ironically, is a problem he cannot solve. We need the government to intervene with two steps. First, the Facebook empire needs to be broken up. America's regulated corporate empires before, and we can do it again. This isn't unprecedented. And surprisingly, it often boosts the value of these companies in the long run. Federal Trade Commission can force Facebook to unwind its acquisitions of WhatsApp and Instagram. Then we'll see real competition around social media and digital messaging. Breaking up Facebook isn't a punishment for its economic success. It's a way to guarantee that other new companies can compete. We also need a new government agency to protect Americans from the overreach of Facebook and other companies like it. Think about it. We don't trust airlines or pharmaceutical companies to regulate themselves, and we shouldn't trust social media companies either. We need basic privacy protections and the ability for people to move their data around as they please. Right now, Facebook makes free speech decisions on its own with little accountability. Instead, we need government to set guidelines, not Facebook employees in Menlo Park. I don't think Mark's a bad guy, but to be honest, I'm angry that Mark's obsession with growth led him to sacrifice security for clicks. I think we all want to live in a country where David can take on Goliath, where a kid with a smart idea in a dorm room can start a billion-dollar company. But we've strayed from that ideal, and breaking up and regulating Facebook will help put us back on that path.
So I'm sure a lot of people will think that this is sour grapes on the part of Mark Zuckerberg's former partner in Facebook. But honestly, he's not the only one speaking out about the fact that at this point, a company that size is creating problems for a democracy that prides itself on having checks and balances. Roger McNamee, from whom you're going to hear next on this KX935's The Sharer Now, with me, Sharon James, and the semi-ironic title Tectonic Disturbances, is another critic. He's written a book called Zucked, and here he is in a Real Vision interview where he's asked whether the just under $4 billion Mark Zuckerberg has agreed to invest in privacy protections is enough and legitimate.
Well, so I would like to believe that it's going to be really effective. I think the challenge of this, and this is the issue that we've discovered as we dig deeper and deeper, is that the problems at Facebook, Google, Instagram, YouTube really go to the business model. And from where I sit, it's not possible to eliminate either the problems to the mental health of the people who use it, the issues for democracy, the issues for privacy, or the issues for competition without altering the business model. And that's not something you do by applying money to the outside. That's something you do by re-engineering the inside. And Mark's uniquely positioned to do that should he choose to do so. I found his 15th anniversary note to be mostly more of the same as opposed to a big breakthrough. And I wasn't expecting different at this point. I first reached out to him in October of 2016. And at the time, I think they were surprised by what I was pointing out, the connections I was making. By October of 2017, it was indisputable. There was a lot of evidence that the issues I was talking about were real, that it was possible to use Facebook to interfere in an election. And then we discovered that it was possible that Facebook had caused a really serious set of issues around personal privacy and that their internal policies for handling data, for gathering data, were so unusual and so extreme that they really warranted intervention. And of course, we've also discovered that as we're learning with Snap and its Snapchat product today, that Facebook's brutal on anyone who comes anywhere near a business that operates. Google is as well. And those are not things that you can resolve with a blog post on the 15th birthday of your company. Those are things that require you going into re-engineering how it operates. And I don't think they're going to do that quietly. I think they're going to have to give people a lot of notice.
Mark said, quote, "There is a tendency of some people to overly emphasize the negative, and in some cases to go so far as saying the shift to empowering people in the ways the internet and these networks do is mostly harmful to society and democracy. To the contrary, while any rapid social change creates uncertainty, I believe that what we're seeing is people having more power and a long-term trend reshaping society to be more open and accountable over time."
But the sad truth is that just last week, Apple had to evict both Facebook and Google from the App Store for 24 hours, revoke all their privileges, because they'd been trying to circumvent Apple's rules related to privacy with what they called a research app that spied on absolutely everything the user did. Now, they paid them a little bit of money, but a meaningful percentage of the people doing it were minors who clearly were not in a position to consent. And it's really clear from Apple's determination of the product that none of the users who were signing up for this had any idea what the implications of doing it would be. The prior week, Facebook found itself in litigation with families where Facebook's policies relative to in-app purchases on games resulted in kids running up bills in thousands of dollars. And Facebook not only encouraged this, it was unwilling to give money back when it was discovered that this was done without the parent or child really understanding what was going on. In addition, Facebook got a lot of credit for creating a database of political ads, you know, in theory to provide transparency, and yet one of the lead researchers working on that database, ProPublica, lost its privileges to look at the database last week, which makes you wonder about whether this is transparent or not. And, you know, that's just in the last week. So I look at this and my concern is that Facebook has an enormous amount of economic power, but it also has massive political power. You know, it has the ability to shape public opinion. And it has, obviously, really great PR people who can make everything they say sound good. But I think, in reality, it's very hard for anyone to influence the company. Mark has absolute control. And the company believes in its mission, which is connecting the whole world, so firmly that they're willing to justify pretty much any action to get there, including ones that run precisely contrary to what Mark just said. So I look at this and say, I don't think the problem is Facebook as an app. I love Facebook as an app. I love sharing things. I love birthdays. I love the things my band can do on it. So in that sense, I agree with him. Where my problem is the business model produces side effects that are the equivalent of chemical spills. And as we know from the chemical industry, for many, many years, nobody told them they had to clean up the mess. So they would pour, you know, mercury and lead and things like that into rivers, and they would just dump it on the side of roads. And eventually society decided that was wrong and that they should pay the cost of cleaning that stuff up. And I think we're coming to the point where society is going to insist that internet platforms like Facebook and Google clean up the messes that they create and bear that cost. And that's the conversation I would like to have. Again, I'm not trying to get rid of Facebook. I'm not trying to get rid of Google. But I am trying to make sure that they are on balance, a positive for society. That matters because new technology is coming now in the form of voice-powered smart devices, you know, with Alexa or Google Home, and artificial intelligence, which are going to extend surveillance in the case of the smart devices and control our lives in the case of the AI in ways we've never seen before and for which we're not prepared and where there hasn't been any discussion about what the standards ought to be for those products. And I just think that those are conversations that need to happen, and Mark is currently not participating. I mean, here's the observation I would make. There have always been people in America and other countries who believe things that were demonstrably not true. People believed in flat earth or whatever. In the years since the development of internet platforms like Facebook and Google, the percentage of the U.S. population that believes things that are demonstrably not true has grown exponentially. Roughly a third of the people in the country deny the connection between human action and climate change. Essentially, all scientists say that that is a clear thing. I think it's 5 or 7% of the population believes there's a link between vaccination and autism, even though not only does everybody say that's not true, but the guy who originally said it made it up. Now, you add those two together, that's 40%. There's almost no overlap in the communities that believe those things. So if 40% of the American public believes things are demonstrably not true, and if products like Facebook and Google contributed to that happening, then we have to recognize that we have a big percentage of our population that's susceptible to manipulation, because Facebook will tell you, if you believe one conspiracy theory, you're prone to another one.
And they're all being disseminated in this global cyberspace. You're tuned to The Sharon Hour with me, Sharon James, on Lagunas KX935, talking tonight about the dangers of cyberspace and the fact that it is currently largely ruled by the empire of Facebook and Google and Amazon, which basically amounts to a handful of men, the CEOs of those companies who control it. So what and where exactly is cyberspace, and what and where is it doing to our heads? Listen now to the late, great Neil Postman.
Cyberspace is a metaphorical idea, which is supposed to be the space where your consciousness is located when you're using computer technology on the internet, for example. The most interesting thing about the term, for me, is that it made me begin to think about where one's consciousness is when interacting with other kinds of media. For example, even when you're reading, where are you? What is the space in which your consciousness is located? When you're watching television, where are you? Who are you? People say with the internet it's a little different in that you're always interacting, or most of the time, with another person. And when you're in cyberspace, I suppose you can be anyone you want, and this is something very different from face-to-face co-presence with another human being. I've mostly decided that new technology, this kind or any other kind, is a kind of Faustian bargain. It always gives us something important, but it also takes away something that's important. That's been true of the alphabet and the printing press and telegraphy right up through the computer. When I hear people talk about the information superhighway, it will become possible to shop at home and bank at home, get your texts at home and get entertainment at home.
Which, of course, has happened and is taken for granted in the 25 years since Neil Postman gave this 1995 interview.
I often wonder if this doesn't signify the end of any meaningful community life. I mean, when two human beings get together and they're co-present, there is built into it a certain responsibility we have for each other. And when people are co-present in family relationships and other relationships, that responsibility is there. You can't just turn off a person. On the internet, you can. Then also, one wonders about social skills. After all, talking to someone on the internet is a different proposition from being in the same room with someone. Not in terms of responsibility, but just in terms of revealing who you are and discovering who the other person is. I'm one of the few people who is opposed to the use of personal computers in school, because school, it seems to me, has always largely been about how to learn as part of a group. School has never really been about individualized learning, but about how to be socialized as a citizen and as a human being. So we have important rules in school, always emphasizing the fact that one is part of a group. And I worry about people who are overloaded with information, which they don't know what to do with, have no sense of what is relevant and what is irrelevant. People who become information junkies. The problem in the 19th century with information was that we lived in a culture of information scarcity. And so humanity addressed that problem, beginning with photography and telegraphy in the 1840s. We tried to solve the problem of overcoming the limitations of space, time, and form. And for about 100 years, we worked on this problem and we solved it in a spectacular way. And now, by solving that problem, we created a new problem that people have never experienced before. Information glut, information meaninglessness, information incoherence. When McLuhan talked about the world becoming a global village, and when people asked about how connections can be made, everyone seemed to think that the world would become, in some good sense, more homogeneous. But we seem to be experiencing the opposite. I mean, all over the world, we see a kind of reversion to tribalism. People are going back to their tribal roots in order to find a sense of identity. I mean, we see it in Russia, in Yugoslavia, in Canada, in our own country, the United States. Why is it that every group now not only is more aware of its own grievances, but seems to want its own education? You know, we want an Afrocentric curriculum and a Korean-centric curriculum and a Greek-centered curriculum. What is it about all this globalization of communication that is making people return to smaller units of identity? It's a puzzle. I think everyone should be sensitive to certain questions. For example, when confronted with a new technology, whether it's a cellular phone or high-definition television or internet, one question should be, what is the problem to which this technology is a solution? And the second question would be, whose problem is it actually? And the third question would be, if there is a legitimate problem here that is solved by the technology, what other problems will be created by my using this technology? About 6 months ago, I bought a new Honda Accord, and the salesman told me that it had cruise control. And I asked him, what is the problem to which cruise control is the solution? By the way, there's an extra charge for cruise control. And he said no one had ever asked him that before, but then he said, well, it's the problem of keeping your foot on the gas. And I said, well, I've been driving for 35 years. I'd never found that to be a problem. I mean, am I using this technology, or is it using me? Because in a technological culture, it is very easy to be swept up in the enthusiasm for technology. And, of course, all the technophiles who adore technology and are promoting it everywhere you turn.
Cruise control, though it's no longer an innovation, is really a very apt metaphor. Yes, it's an advantage if you don't trust yourself to stay within societally enforced boundaries. But think about who's doing the cruise control. Think about the fact that you are putting someone else in charge and someone who stands to profit by being in charge. In the case of the internet, Google, Amazon, Facebook. So it is a Faustian bargain, no question. What you just heard from the late author, theorist, cultural critic Neil Postman was from an interview he did 25 years ago. And yet the questions he told us to pose to ourselves are even more relevant today than they were a quarter of a century ago. So is anyone a little more concerned about the effects of the internet after listening to this show? Certainly the internet has done some wonderful things. Certainly it has provided huge convenience and time-saving devices. But what are we actually doing with our time saved is a question we should also be asking ourselves. And is it worth the dire constitutional changes it's rendering? I mean, literally our civilization is changing quite dramatically, has changed quite dramatically with cyberspace, and could change even more dramatically if we progress on a linear path. It could be a path to our destruction as individuals. I know that sounds extreme, but think of it this way. Utilities, the provision of them, and the withholding of them, or even the threat of the withholding of them, have always been at the root of totalitarianism. And once we depend on any particular utility, we also become dependent on who's providing it. So the very least we should do if we want to remain a democracy is be creating a huge divergence in terms of who's providing and not putting it in the hands of single individuals and profiteers, I think. Well, that's it for my share in our tonight. For the rebroadcasting of this show on podcast, go to kx935.com/shows/the-sharon-hour. That's sharing without the G, a pun on my name, hour with the H. I'm Sharon James, and I do hope you have a wonderful week ahead and come back and listen for more Sharon Hours every Monday night at 9 p.m.